Good evening. Welcome or welcome back to Writers at Warwick. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to Warwick Michael Holroyd. It's not his first visit to this arts centre. Last time, I think, was for a conference we had on the needs of writers. His activities on behalf of writers are an area of his work that's perhaps a bit less known than his biographies. Everybody knows his Lytton Strachey, his Augustus John, his George Bernard Shaw, his work as one of the leading biographers in the English-speaking world. But he's also kind of a one-man quango in terms of the world of letters. He's been he's run Penn, he's run the Society of Authors, he's been on the Arts Council, he's now president of the Royal Society of Literature. And in those roles, as well as in other aspects of his work, he's been a huge influence on behalf of writers who make their living by writing. Those who don't have the cushions of academic life and of salaries and of pensions to look forward to, but whose only income is, as Michael's always has been, from their pen. I'm thinking particularly of his role in getting public lending right off the ground after a long campaign. That's the system by which writers earn a little bit of money from the borrowings of their books from public libraries, but in many other respects too. Now, recently, the biographer has turned his gaze inward on his family, on his own upbringing, in a kind of now two-volume Bildungsroman, Basel Street Blues, and most recently, Mosaic. Wonderful, vivid books in a particular tradition of English life writing or self-life writing. And he's going to be reading from them this evening, and you'll get a sense, if you haven't already read them, of their vividness. And also, and I think this is too little said about Michael's writing, of their humour. He's an immensely funny writer, as well as everything else. He'll read for 20 minutes or so, as long as he wants to. Then I have a couple of questions I want to put to him, and I'm going to use my introducer's rights to get those in before the rest of you, but I know that you'll have questions for him, and he's very happy to talk, I understand, not just about these books, though there's plenty to talk about in relation to them, but about his work as a biographer and about other questions about the literary world at large. So please join me in welcoming Michael Holroyd.
Well, thank you for that very generous introduction, which I will have to try and live up to now. I want to give two readings from my so-called family memoirs, which is my form of autobiography. And the first one from Basel Street Blues, which came out in 1999, and the second one from this very recent book, just out now, called Mosaic. Basel Street Blues, I should say, was put in the music department of many bookshops. So look for Mosaic in the art department. My first reading covers really my late teens and early 20s. In other words, we're in the 1950s. My parents have divorced and are remarried, and that was rather a rare thing in those days. And the episode I'm going to read follows the fortunes of my mother and the strange role I played in her often remarried life. After I left school, I joined a firm of lawyers in Windsor, very near Windsor Castle. A very gloomy Dickensian place, I remember. Buses past the door, going one in one direction to Dedworth and in the other direction to Gravesend. And I worked in an attic office with a rather straight-laced solicitor called Mr. Owen. And sometimes my mother would telephone me there for what I would call semi-legal advice. One other thing you should know before this reading is that my mother was Swedish. Although the 1950s was an indecisive decade for me, my mother was making plenty of decisions. One morning, while I was still working as an article clerk in Windsor, she telephoned me to say that she had discovered that her husband, Eddie, had been having an affair with Mrs. Hanbury, a tenant on the first floor. "What shall I do?" my mother suddenly asked. She seldom took any action, however ruinous, without first asking my advice. But it was awkward giving advice over Mr. Owen's telephone in Windsor. The quality of my advice, its timbre and sheer slowness of delivery, had gained me an odd reputation for maturity. I would pause a good deal and produce a series of noises in my throat that conveyed gravity and experience. My silences, hedged around with an air of pondering wisdom, sounded powerfully deep. When I did speak, I used whereas and nevertheless and on the other hand pretty freely. While I was putting on this performance, the other person would usually make it clear what he or she wanted to do, and I would then triumphantly chime in with that conclusion. What my mother wanted to do, rather to my surprise, was to divorce Eddie and start another chapter in her life. I suspect that she already had her next chapter sketched in and was eager to get on with it. The decree nisi was granted on the 25th of January 1955 and made absolute in the second week of March. They had been married almost exactly 6 years. My mother was now aged 38. Her next telephone call was to tell me that she was marrying once more. Her third marriage was celebrated at the Chelsea Registry Office on the 12th of May, 1955. She wore a Dior dress of pink and black silk organza and black velvet, according to the evening newspapers. The marriage was widely covered by the national press. This was partly because my mother had recently begun modelling clothes for the dress designer Charles Creed, having shown the spring fashions that year to the Queen of Persia. The marriage was additionally newsworthy because she was marrying the son of a famous actor-manager. My new stepfather, David Nares, was a 41-year-old advertising executive who managed the Martini contract for the Crawford Agency. He was the son of Owen Nares, star of several silent films, melodramas and romances, such as The Sorrows of Satan, Young, Lochinvar, and The Private Life of Don Juan. David, his son, my new stepfather, liked firing off reverberating letters to the Daily Mail and Sunday Times, calling for a stronger British fighting force against the red menace of Soviet Russia, and cursing young people in modern society for expecting something for nothing. "Let us all roll up our sleeves," one of his letters exhorts readers. "Let us all roll up our sleeves and get down to hard work." He himself was a hard drinker and would sometimes roll up his sleeves at dinner when explaining how alcohol was a necessary solvent in his business. I occasionally stayed a few days at their home on the Chelsea embankment. "I don't want you treating the place like a hotel," my stepfather welcomed me. But it was difficult not to do so if, simply by going in and out of the front door, you were judged to be downgrading the house in that way. On the other hand, my stepfather added, it would be a pleasant relief to enjoy some good conversation for a change. Women, he suspected, were incapable of conversation. Certainly my mother was. The sort of newspaper talk that passed for conversation at Chelsea Embankment struck her as intolerably dull. My stepfather liked to ask me, man to man, what I thought of the Cyprus situation, or the CND march to Aldermaston protesting against the hydrogen bomb. And I was clearing my throat, tilting my head, when suddenly my mother would spring up, switch on the radio, and start whirling around the room, clicking her fingers. My stepfather, abandoning Cyprus and the CND, unavailingly called her to heel. Both of them were already fairly drunk, my stepfather having tanked up at various clubs and bars on his way back from the office, and my mother having fortified herself against his homecoming with several secret whiskies. At this stage, my stepfather usually said something offensive about Swedish neutrality in the war. He then announced that he was going to change for dinner. He would make his way to the bathroom, and we heard the splashing of bathwater. 20 minutes later, he would reappear in exactly the same clothes, except for a new white collar above his old striped shirt. In the belief, apparently, that he was displaying aristocratic manners, My stepfather called my mother Mrs. Nurse over dinner, though at no other time. This struck her as unfriendly and led to an increase in her drinking. When she was drunk, she became extraordinarily silly and fell down a lot before passing out altogether. When he was drunk, my stepfather became aggressive. When I was drunk, I was sick. No, that was how matters usually stood when, at the end of the evening, my stepfather would bang the table with his fist and shout out the word, bed. He would do this even when there were guests, or go off to his bedroom and then come back in his pajamas and dressing gown to show those who still had their wits about them it was time to leave. My mother did soon leave. It was, I think, sometime in 1957 that she telephoned again to ask for my advice. She had recently been on holiday to Baden, or was it Baden-Baden? Anyway, she'd been abroad for the sake of the air or water, and encountered a very polite Viennese gentleman who apparently manufactured everything from ballpoint pens to motor bicycles somewhere in South America. She had often dreamed of travelling to South America, and she wanted my advice as to whether she should set off there now. Aegon, her new admirer, passed all his summers in Europe, so she would be able to see me each year. Perhaps, when all else failed, I could come over and manufacture motor bicycles myself. I replied with one of my profound pauses, made a few gravelly noises in my throat, and uttered a perfectly balanced sentence with a nevertheless at its centre. Then we got down to planning her journey. Before she went off to the airport, my mother asked me to draft an explanatory note for your stepfather. This she copied down, leaving it for him on his return from the office. That evening, my stepfather telephoned me to say that your mother had gone abroad. His voice sounded wobbly, and I went over to see him. This was a different conversation from the ones we usually struck up, and all gentlemanly airs and pretenses were shed. My stepfather was somewhat bald, but had a good growth of hair at the sides of his head, which he kept tugging until these tufts stood out fantastically over his ears. We drank several tumblers of whiskey, man to man, but for once he did not grow aggressive, and I was not sick. Eventually he asked me to help him draft a letter to my mother, who had left a forwarding address. "You're a writer," he said. "You can put it on paper." This was the first time he had acknowledged my wish to be a writer. Much gratified, I took up my pen, the very pen with which I had recently drafted my mother's farewell note, and hoping the whiskey would inspire me, began writing. Some 3 weeks later, I heard from my mother in Acapulco. She had received, she wrote, a very curious letter from your stepfather. I was wondering how she should reply. Would I help her? Well, I did try to help her. I drafted an answer. So began what, for 18 months or so, was to be an elaborate international correspondence with myself. I was not really aware of what I was doing, of the irony of what I was doing, as I bent over these letters acting barrister for, almost being biographer, of both husband and wife. But I did notice I was beginning to pay myself some extravagant compliments. "Your excellent letter," and so on. Well, I won't go on to tell you the way that resolved itself, if resolution it can be called. So that was from Basel Street Blues in the 1950s. I thought I would read an excerpt from Mosaic, since I'm at a university, which covers my attempt to teach at a university in the States, Pennsylvania, Penn State University. It was, you will be able to judge what it was. In 1979, the age of 44, I accepted an invitation to teach a couple of courses, one undergraduate and the other postgraduate, at Pennsylvania State University. I planned to combine 2 days a week teaching with trips to those manuscript libraries in the United States which held the papers of Bernard Shaw, whose biography I was then writing. This developed into a hectic 16-week program involving over 50 flights to and from Penn State. If there's a blockbuster to be written about round Pittsburgh Airport, I'm your man. I had never taught anything before, indeed never been a student at a university, let alone a university abroad. My initial nervousness was exacerbated when, on arrival, I was handed, with an air of urgency, some bulky medical insurance documents. Apparently my predecessor, a scientist who had come from Middle Europe, had fallen ill, and being improperly insured, did not qualify for the proper treatment. The result had been a bad case, or so I gathered, a bad case of death. In the circumstances, I signed everything that was placed before me rather eagerly, and after a few questions about my teaching schedule, prepared to enter the classroom. Taking a formidable breath, squaring my shoulders, and putting on an expression of authority, I marched in. But what impression did I actually create? He was disappointing on all counts, remembered one of my students. She, with most of the others, had been speculating over what this mysterious professor from abroad would be like. It was generally assumed that, having come so far, I would carry round me a prevailing air of importance, would strike them all as indefinably fascinating, and be, of course, proper and precise in the best British tradition. Indeed, in my fashion, I had tried to meet all these expectations. But as I entered, a cup of coffee in one hand and a bundle of books and tapes under my other arm, there was a murmur of dismay. No bowler, no cane, no pipe, no distinguished beard. What a letdown. I did not know then that most of my students had been dragooned into attending these classes as part of their literature requirements. They were not volunteers. A press release had been circulated around the humanities department, making me out to be a very significant person. In the library stood two glass cases that had been importantly prepared with the credentials of my career, fellowships, and the rumour of prizes, favourable reviews and illustrated interviews, manuscript notes, and first editions, which were, in truth, less rare than second editions. Standing in front of it all later that day, I felt intimidated by this array. Obviously, it was the living embodiment of these glass cases that my students had expected to see entering the classroom. My one immediate asset seemed to be my British voice. My peculiar accent was something, however, of a cultural barrier. Was I being funny? Or was I serious? It was so difficult to tell. By the second week, they had mostly decided that I was at least trying to be funny. It was probably British irony, that most awkward of all styles to translate. But they had been guided to their decisions more by my appearance and behaviour than by what I actually said. I was the man who came rushing into the classroom every week looking a little bit like a curious mixture of Rex Harrison and Jerry Lewis, another student wrote. In other words, a blatant comic. What struck several of them during my carefully structured course was the informality, sometimes reaching into chaos, and my air of helplessness in the middle of it all. Mr. Holroyd is very bad at looking stern. I was surprised to read that sentence, since I had been practicing sternness in front of the mirror until it almost cracked. But eventually I decided that here was one student's brave stab at that sophisticated literary device, the unreliable narrator, and I annotated her essay accordingly. I had, they all observed, a desperate mannerism of running my fingers through my hair every few minutes. One student drew an impression of my constantly rearranged hair underneath her description of it. His hair is wild, she observed. It's amazing the way he gets it to stand up and lay down flat in such a chaotic pattern. These comments about me arose in part as part of, and perhaps in retaliation to, the final assignment I had set my students early on in this course. It was a biography and autobiography course, and as their final paper, the very essay that would carry their grades, I had asked them to write a pen portrait in miniature of myself. There was a gasp of genuine horror when they heard this. I was no longer amused, wrote one of them. Never had they heard anything so vainglorious. But then perhaps it was some trick. I was often playing tricks, they thought, on the poor students. For example, among the 10 or 12 books I had set them were a couple I disliked. Why would I choose a bad book for them to read? The reason gradually became clear. I did not want them to second-guess what I thought. I did not want them to try and please me. I wanted to know what they thought themselves and to make any differing reactions to the text the basis of our discussions. Should they deduce, therefore, that I did not want them to please me with this final paper too, the pen portrait of myself? How much hostile criticism would I accept without downgrading their papers? How much flattery could I swallow without being sick? From a number of the essays I wrote, I found out that during one of the coffee breaks, they had discussed whether or not I was homosexual. We did not in those days use the words gay or lesbian. In the end, they decided that I wasn't. But how could they be certain? Did anyone dare ask me? And if anyone did, would I answer truthfully? Only one student pressed her inquiries further. And that last sentence shows you what they were up against. What exactly does it mean? The American language these days is stronger than the English language. It's blunter, ruder, more muscular, demotic, direct. It's pitted lavishly with assholes, bombarded with a hell of a lot of kicked butt, and does not boast the delicate, smooth bottom of British English. Of course, English can be elegant, but its elegance is so often evasive, oblique, ambiguous. Here was a cultural obstacle my students had to get round to understand my game, decode my language, discover my secrets. One evening, when the students came over for supper, we continued our discussion. We sat around pouring out various odd, uneven bottles, now one, then another. And I thought that this was the sort of group discussion I had missed when young, never having been to a university. Only it was focused on me because of that dreadful paper I had set. One student suggested I was wearing a self-protective mask and wondered why. Soon, they were teasing me tremendously, getting their own back, enjoying themselves. There was much laughter as their speculations spiraled into fantasy. The food came to my rescue. I had by now drunk quite a lot. In this warm social atmosphere, my enigmatic manner was beginning to acquire a flavour of poignancy. My apartment, they noticed, was bare. No flowers, no pictures. While in London, they knew I had no domestic animals, not even a frog or stick insect. So I was obviously a solitary, and yet I appealed from the centre of my crowded supper party, swaying slightly. I was gregarious. I actually liked people, some people, and also various animals. Even so, my students spied a dangerous fate in store for me, and from that they plucked a delightful solution to their problem. I had been keeping company with the dead, my biographical subjects, too long, and set them the task of rescuing me from those glass cases in the library. There were several ways in which they set about this. Next morning, I had an awful hangover. So that's my teaching experience. And now I'm going.
Well, it's great to hear about your teaching experience, Michael. And I'm certainly not going to follow your example and risk getting my students to write about me. It reminds me tangentially of P.D. James's story about teaching in America. Detective stories are known in America as mysteries, of course. And everywhere she went, people would say, "This is Professor James, she teaches the mystery," which as a high church Anglican, she felt was
excellent.
Sort of an enthralling thing to be
alleged
to be doing.
Yeah, elevation.
Teaching the mystery, yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you about some more serious aspects of Mosaic, which are foreshadowed in Basel Street Blues. There's one of my favourite moments in Basel Street Blues is the story you tell of when you were planning to write your first biography of Hugh Kingsmill, and you go to dinner with one of Kingsmill's daughters, and when you arrive early in your anxiety to make a good impression, you find that the house is on fire. And
that's true.
So, well, that's another question I want to ask.
Well,
the fire engine's outside.
Yes,
and you think, well, It's probably not the right moment to intrude. So rather than rushing in to help extinguish the blaze, you hold back until it's safely put out, and then you go in when things are quietened down. And it occurred to me that there's a sort of little metaphor there about, in a way, what a biographer, as distinct from an autobiographer, does, which is to come in after the flames have died down and to explore what's there. Now, in turning to yourself, you've increasingly, and particularly as you get into writing about, for example, your relationship with Philippa Puller in Mosaic, been going into the flames rather more, into the emotional conflagrations of your earlier life. And I wondered whether you felt there was a very big change of gear as you sat and wrote from doing your biographical writing to doing something as intimate as that.
I was rather challenged by some readers of Battle Street Blues who, while writing very nicely about it, said I had not revealed myself enough. I had only a walk-on part in my own autobiography. Now, I believed I was in every word I'd written. I believed that I could be found easily through reflections and echoes, through genetic patterns of my parents and grandparents, and so on. But it is true that I didn't step right to the front of the stage. And when I was asked by one or two, Margaret Forster was one of them, Blake Morrison another, to come forward myself and do things less obliquely, I thought this was impossible. Now, what Margaret Forster said particularly was, having a mother who was very beautiful and very young, she was only 18 when I was born, and she was very glamorous, much younger than I was, as it were, what effect this had had on my relationships with women early on. And my first reaction to that question was, I can't possibly write this. I don't know, but I can't address that challenge. And then I thought that was very feeble of me, and that I would have a go, I would try. And so I wrote about Philippa Puller, with whom I lived from the late 1960s to the mid 1970s, before we went our separate ways, and who, before she died in the 1990s, I was seeing again, and we'd become very good friends. With Philippa, she intensified all experience, for good and for what was frightening. She nearly committed suicide once. I had to actually ring 999 and so on. I mean, they were terrible times, but they were rather wonderful times too. Everything which one did with Philippa was, as I say, intensified. Colors were brighter, and life was a tremendous switchback. And so I thought I would try. And while I was writing, of course, it's a perfectly private act, writing. There I am in my room, and I'm writing. I'm writing in the old style with a pen on paper. Actually, I write my books on the backs of typescripts of old books, strangely. And I did that. And I did write round to a few people who'd known her to get some of their memories and see how they fitted in with mine, and to give another view, even of me and her together. And when I read some of this in a newspaper, I was shocked. But when I wrote it in the book, I thought that was all right. And one of the points of biography is to bring the dead, insofar as one possibly can, back to life on the page, to keep death in its place. Yeah. And so I'm now glad I did that. I found it almost impossible to start. But once I was writing, I couldn't stop. So it was interesting. So perhaps there was an internal need to do it.
It's interesting that even so, as you've been talking about somebody else mainly and not about yourself. And I'm thinking about that self-protective mask that the students detected and about what goes on in biography. Of course, it is a paradox of autobiography that it's inevitably about other people. People write about their parents and their exotic uncles and aunts and so on. You had a particularly exotic background, so there's a whole lot to write about.
I maintain, of course, that although my background was extremely eccentric and exotic, as you say, so is everybody else's. If only they knew it, if only they could find out, perhaps go back two generations, and things are not so regular, and not so conventional, and people do sometimes hide things that were embarrassing, things that were painful in the past, and we all, there is no such thing as absolute convention. Mm-hmm. We've all got strange backgrounds, I believe. And that's really what's come through these two books from people writing to me. And they will say, my goodness, your mother was... sometimes they say, I wish your mother could have met my father. Sometimes they, but sometimes they say, do you know, that story of yours just reminds me of mine. And then they will tell me their story, which is completely different. But it has an echo, a reflection of what I'm saying. And the impression I've got is of a great forest of family trees, which is rather a stranger place than some of us realize.
That's really interesting. I'm thinking partly about something that V.S. Pritchard, I've been thinking about lately, who also wrote very vividly about his background, but in a way that was possibly rather more about the people in his background rather than about himself.
Yes.
When he came to write biography, which he did the other way round, in his old age, he wrote some biographies, Turgenev, Chekhov, Balzac. He said at one point, the trouble with writing biography is that it's novels without dialogue, because you don't know what people said to each other.
No, you don't.
You know all sorts of things about them, but you can't put in the actual words.
Well, I think that's a very good point, and the only way that non-fiction writers can get round that is by using sometimes short quotations from journals or from letters to have that same immediacy as dialogue. In the old days, I could write to you and say, will you come to supper tonight? And you could reply to me on the same day and say, yes, what time? And I could reply to you on the same day and say, 8 o'clock. And that is a form of dialogue. So you can sometimes get an immediacy by short quotations, I think.
Yes. There's in both forms, not in fiction, but in biography and autobiography, there's this question that you touched on of tact, of whether you're going to hurt people. How much of a problem is that? Have you ever felt that you couldn't really tell a truth in a book for that kind of reason?
I have always shown people the passages, the pages that involve them. I haven't shown sort of daughters, brothers, first cousins, and so it can go on forever, that. But I've always shown living people the passages that I want to use. And sometimes they have objected. But if I have said to them, right, I'll leave it all out, or I'll use a pseudonym, they say, no, don't do that. And very often it's not so much the matter, but the tone which matters. And I have learned something of that. I think you can have... I had a very good arrangement with James Strachey, who was Lytton Strachey's brother and copyright holder. I showed him the whole book in draft, and he would argue with me over some things, and sometimes I realised he was completely right, knew more than I did, and I could get a better narrative. But sometimes we locked antlers and we wouldn't move. And the arrangement we made was that I would have my narrative, but he could have a footnote. So I would walk on the carpet and he could tweak it from under my feet. And that was a very sophisticated and amiable way of doing it. Mm. I've only once left something out, which I put in a later edition. And that was the fact that Augustus John never married Aurelia John, and that the children were illegitimate. Mm. And the reason I left it out in the first thing was that they would not have inherited the money and the will. And I thought, I can't do that. So there was a story, which I couldn't quite use originally, when Augustus John, aged 60, the old bohemian republican, was offered a knighthood. And he was delighted. And then the palace got to know that he was not actually married to Aurelia, and these were, and they asked him whether he would regularize the position by getting married. And so he went to
so that there would be a legitimate Lady John.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So there would be a Lady John. And so he went to Duralia, and he did the thing properly. He went down on his knee, and and she said no. After all that time together. I mean, they're always going to get married, but there was always something more important, the finishing of a picture or her vegetable garden. And so he was rather round off and went to the pub and so on. And 2 years later, they gave him the Order of Merit, which didn't involve marital status. That I had to leave out in the first edition because it would have excommunicated and the children. But it's in the last edition.
Interesting. Well, there's so much more I'd like to ask you about, but I'm being too greedy, and I know that there are questions out here which may be about all kinds of things. We have to do this because of these fierce lights that we have on us, and I'll have to repeat your questions because although I may be able to hear them, perhaps people behind you can't. So who's going to kick off?
Kick off is the difficult thing.
Always an awkward moment, this, isn't it? Ben.
I wondered if after with Robert Skidelsky you did God's Fifth Column, and you did the foreword for the new pre-on edition of the Polyglots. I wondered if you'd ever considered writing about Gerhardi more. Really.
So it's a question about writing about William Gerhardi, to whom you've written introductions to his fiction.
Well, there's a very good biography of Gerhardi by Dido Davis. It's really very
good.
And I had written, as you say, an introduction to the Polyglots and edited and introduced with Robert Skidelsky that God's Fifth Column. This is a posthumous work of Gerhardi. Gerhardi was a novelist who denied strongly speaking with a Russian intonation. I remember, but always did. Who'd been brought up in Russia. And he was a tremendous success in the 1920s. With particularly two books, Futility and the Polyglots. They're really wonderful books. I do recommend those two novels. And he wrote in the 30s, and then suddenly he became silent. And it was a mystery. And I got to know him a bit. And he was a tremendous speaker on the telephone. 7 hours would not be beyond him. And if he would say, William, the place is on fire, I've got to go. You say, yes, but about the second chapter in the Polyglots. and he was very endearing, indeed. And if you felt perfectly well and you had a long conversation with William, you felt absolutely drained and exhausted by the end. But if you were ill, he really was a wonderful tonic, because being ill, you only think of your own illness. But you began to think of the Polyglots instead. And I had a very, very soft spot for him. Also, I think he was an extraordinarily talented, an oddly talented writer. But Dido Davis's biography is really good, and therefore I don't think, and she used all the papers at Cambridge University Library, I don't think there's anything more I can do. I had a book of what I call non-fiction short stories called Works on Paper, which came out a couple of years ago, and there is an essay on William in that book. I owe him a great deal, I think. There's somebody over there.
To what extent do you feel you can really get to the truth of another person when you're writing a biography, even with all the information available?
The question is, to what extent can the biographer really get to the truth of another person?
Well, insofar as I'm accused of not giving the truth about myself, it's because I've taken on, really, I've involved myself for a long time in other people's lives. To write on Bernard Shaw took me over 15 years. Day after day, I had his letters, his handwriting, things that belonged to him in my hand. And inevitably, you get a certain truth, the factual truth, what followed what. You can check that. The meaningful truth. But how can you get the magical truth as well, the tone? Well, there is no absolute truth, because if we both meet someone, we will have different truths, perhaps. But I think you can get a sense of intimacy with the past. I've always likened writing biography to walking on a tightrope between, on the one side, too much involvement, which means you become sentimental, and the other side, just too much detachment. in which you become boring, just information retrieval. But if you can walk that tightrope and put out your hand and get a sense of intimacy with the past, that is what you're trying to do. So that one is almost a messenger from the dead, if you like. And I like to think some people, of course, when dead, combine better, wish to be heard more, and some people don't. But if that sort of combination of you and the subject works, what you're trying to do, really, is to write one more, or rather invite the dead person to write one more book, posthumously, and in collaboration. And I think you can do that. But I don't think, I mean, the Strachey took me in the end 10 years, the Augustus John almost the same for the final edition, and Shaw 15. These are marathon things, and I'm not sure I could quite have the time to do another like that.
There's something I want to ask you in relation to the evidence side of things, letters and diaries and manuscripts and all that research that you've done so thoroughly and managed not to be overwhelmed by, but to bring to life in that magical way that you describe so vividly. It sometimes seemed to me that one can find that because there's an imbalance in the evidence, there'd be a particular period in a subject's life or a particular aspect of a subject's life about which there's masses and masses of material.
Yeah.
And there'll be another bit where there's next to nothing. And one has, as a writer, a sense at the same time that there has to be some kind of shape to the narrative which doesn't yield to that inequality of evidence. So you're slightly, if you respond to that, you're rigging it a bit.
Perhaps rigging it a bit. I mean, this is an accusation. When you have a mass of evidence, you have to edit it. You have to select very much.
Mm.
You've got a mass of evidence there. You've got a mass of evidence there, and a bit of a desert there. But you know what's each end. Now you can speculate. You flag it up as speculation, but you can speculate how you get from there where you know to there. And you know the person, and you can speculate, and indeed invite the reader to have his or her own thing. But it's not possible to keep an absolutely even narrative, and perhaps you don't even need to or want to. You have to change gear a bit, I think.
Yeah.
And some bits of the narrative, you can go quick, and you're not taking a great load on. And some bits, you've got a heavy load, and you have to change gear and go slower. Mm. And the reader should have confidence that at other times, it will be going quick. That's how the narrative works.
Yeah. Other questions?
Yes. My question is the Strachey one, and this magic you've been talking about came through to me very clearly in this work. And I was wondering, there should be almost a difference in kind between the recreation of someone's life and the involvement you must have had going to James Strachey's house constantly every day, reading the letters, etc. And the kind of perhaps more introspective endeavor of writing about yourself. Is it actually almost a process of self-discovery? Is it actually a difference in kind rather than a difference in focus?
So the question is about the difference between researching another subject where there's a project of investigation to undergo and looking into yourself to write about yourself, and whether there is a real difference. Is that a fair summary of what you asked?
The paradox is, I think, that you can sometimes give a better air of intimacy when writing about somebody else. You've forgotten so much about yourself. If somebody said to me, what were you doing in September 1960 or whatever, I wouldn't know, but I would know what Augustus John was doing then. I have the papers. And there's something completely different about technique. With writing about famous people, with archives, wherever they are, you have a lot to work from, with which to create, recreate. Now, with myself, my parents and grandparents didn't write letters. Occasionally a postcard for the sake of the picture on the other side. And there were a few family albums, but I noticed that in the captions, only the dogs were identified, never the people, very English. So I had a completely different technique of how to put a narrative together from just odds and ends, rather than a mass of paper, which I would have to reduce. But the mass of paper, of course, one can find out about, oh, well, love affairs and things that were important, vital for the subject. Whereas it is strange, in order to go on, we have to shed some things. We have to forget some things. And it's the process of remembering. Sometimes you have to write to other people who will jog your memory, and then memory comes to the aid of memory, and you're on your way. But it's a different technique. I'm glad you think the Strachey has that intimacy, because I certainly was much moved when writing it. I would other people thought I was more alive in that world than I was in my own world, though I think that's going a little far. But with somebody like Carrington, nobody knew who Carrington was. Now, of course, there's been a film with her name and exhibition, but at that stage, no one, except for those friends who still were alive and one or two members of the family, nobody had ever heard of her. And seeing those letters, those extraordinary diaries, and trying to recreate her, I felt I was like a fiction writer creating a vivid character. I was, in fact, recreating her, but it was a parallel sort of effort, I think, in a way.
That whole issue of memory in writing about yourself is so interesting, and of course now you have done it. That will the danger is that that will be fixed in your own mind as your story, and you won't be able to remember anything else except what you wrote down. You must have had the experience of interviewing people who've yes. written their memoirs, and what they tell you is what's in their book.
Yes.
They tell you nothing except what's in their book that you've already read. It's terribly
yes,
frustrating.
Absolutely
the different
true.
Spin on this.
That's absolutely
was a,
true.
A story that, of Mick Jagger, a friend of mine was asked by Mick Jagger to ghost his autobiography. And it, as a result of knowing the ghost, I met Mick Jagger and asked him about this project, and he said, well, the trouble is there's all these books about me and they all, you know, they get everything wrong, you know. So I wanted to put the record straight. But the trouble is I've got very bad memory. So when John asks me anything, I have to look it up in those books.
That's very good. Very good story.
There are other questions. If Michael could choose somebody else to write about him,
would not like to be on the other end of it. That is certainly true. And although I don't destroy papers, I don't meticulously keep them either. So I think there. Let me just say there are these days some wonderful biographers, real writers. It's been a wonderful time in which to write biography. Standards are continually going up. There's experiments being made ever since the time of Richard Ellman's Joyce and George Painter's Proust in the late 1950s. It's been an extraordinary time, a most exciting time in which to write biography. I think that time is to some extent changing. And I think there are going to be fewer books which begin with the birth and end with the death and are very full books. I think people are going to be more partial. They're going to choose a bit of the life, or a particular relationship, a year of Keats's life, or whatever it may be, rather than the full thing. I think there's going to be a change, and so there should be. But it's been a wonderful time, and do you notice how I failed to answer your question?
Question here.
Of the Bloomsbury literature that your Strachey biography stimulated, do you have particular favorites that you would recommend?
There are some wonderful books now. Hermione Lee's Virginia Woolf is a very considerable book, and in its time, Quentin Bell's was extremely interesting. Gerald Brennan's autobiography. Wonderful book, a really romantic book. What Bloomsbury has been very fortunate in is that posthumously, the diaries, Virginia Woolf's diaries, letters, so on, and other people's, I mean, have come out, Vanessa Bell's letters, so on. And this has added a great deal of interest to the creative work that they did in their lifetime. And Lytton Strachey's letters are due to come out next year, edited by Paul Levy. and I should probably find that I got a number of things wrong. but that has been, I think it's a very rich field, and people always begin their reviews by saying, oh, not another book about Bloomsbury. And then they go and say, actually, this is quite good.
Do you get a feeling that there are more biographers than subjects around at the moment?
Well, I don't know. I think my American publisher said to me not so long ago, he said, Michael, you can write anything you want for us, but no more biography.
Thanks a lot.
I opened myself up like I admit. And I think that America has gone off biography a bit now. That's my feeling. And also, there is a bit of an illusion about biography. Look at the public lending. You mentioned public lending. Look at the public lending right figures. 1.7% of biography, no more. And that takes in biographies of Diana and so on. I feel I wouldn't say this in public, but I think it's less popular than it is reputed to be. We have to work very hard, I think, to earn a living. So I think it's not that easy. And it's not quite as popular. They're big, big books, some of these things. And if they become part of the academic required reading, well, it's impossible for people to get through everything. So there's there's an academic resistance still to biography, I think.
Well, it's a curious thing. I did want to ask you about that. There is a curious ambivalence in the academic world, isn't there? I mean, a lot of very good biographies are written by people with university posts.
Yes,
you
course.
Mentioned Hermione Lee,
yes.
Dick Ellman,
yes.
both of whom had the same professorship at Oxford, obviously at different times.
Yes.
And yet there is also this very strong sense that biography is somehow not a respectable thing for academics to interest themselves in, perhaps because it's too interesting, but perhaps also more respectably a feeling that it gets in between the reader and, if it's a literary biography, the work of the writer, and perhaps it runs the risk of being reductive.
Yes, it runs the risk.
Do you think there is anything in that?
Well, I think there's bad biography, just as there's bad anything else, and certain things are press-button things and are reductive. But it seems to me that in a good literary biography, you see the parallel story, if you like, to the novel or whatever it is. And I think that the lives of writers lie between the text in those blank spaces. And if you can read them in an imaginative way, connect one with the other, you enrich the text and you do not reduce it.
Mm.
Not everything is plain, simple autobiography. But it is true that this person, that person wrote that, and no one else could have written quite that.
Mm. If there are, yes, there's another question here.
I just wondered how you view political biographies. There's still a plethora of political biographies. I just wondered if, in a way, do you feel in a way from achieving the discipline of biography? I wonder if that's part of that trend.
The question is about political biography in relation to what Michael's just been saying about perhaps a reduction in public interest in biography and the fact that there are so many biographies of politicians coming out still.
Yes, there are, of course.
Politicians get huge advances from them too, don't they?
We have that grievance too, the rest of us. That's absolutely true. They are the hares in the race, whereas, of course, you remember that the tortoise won the race eventually. What I think about political biography is people who write it cannot wait to get over childhood, adolescence, until the first public speech, as it were. It's much more part of history in that sense, as opposed to biography, where I think the childhood and adolescence, providing you can find out enough about it, is very important. It needn't be just psychoanalytical, but I believe that it is of genuine interest in itself. And I'm not keen to get to the first published book, as it were. I think there's much more to it than that. So there, it's a different genre to quite a degree, I think, on the whole. There are some politicians, Healy, for example, who writes rather well, it seems to me. Roy Hattersley writes well. His autobiography, A Yorkshire Childhood, is a really good autobiography. It's really good, and he deals with childhood. So there are many exceptions to this, but I feel that it's more the public life on the whole that the historian biographer is interested in, and whereas the literary biographer is interested in something else, the private life, of course, and the publications, but it's a different focus, a different way of looking at it.
I'm not sure whether there was a question back the neck. Well, thank you very much for some interesting questions, and thank you even more, Michael, for reading so enjoyably and talking so well about your work. I just wanted to say that I think you've given a very vivid sense of the creative side of this non-fiction work. And one of the things that comes through very vividly and movingly from your autobiographical writing is the, perhaps to people who don't know you well and who know you as a public figure and as somebody who's written biographies of other people, the creative, vulnerable, bohemian, rather reckless person who one might associate with the kind of creative impetus that you've given voice to this evening. Thank you very much for coming to Warwick.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice.